Ashe. We'll pour to the creative spirit the great Ashe out of which we all emerge. Ashe. We pour to that creative spirit by whatever name we know it, whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science. Ashe.
Okay.
We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour the next libation to their grandchildren and their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Monomotapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who great the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Mande civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Nuer. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open air pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. We pour to the ancestors who did not know as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. We pour to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who, finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Puerto Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places, learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, "Oh my God, oh Madre de Dios," who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories. We pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand, and who sit here, buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with the Dinka symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions. The children of those who could not be killed, we pour, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction, and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York. Their children's children, who making a way for themselves became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents. Those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, "Stop! No more! We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths." We pour for those ancestors, some of whom came to Howard University in 2004 and followed these caskets all the way back to New York. We pray to the great ancestors, the ones whose names we know and the ones whose names we don't. And at this moment, as we pour this libation, I would ask anyone who feels comfortable to say the name of someone in your bloodline who is no longer physically here, but who you know made it possible for you to be here. Go ahead, let's hear the names. Haywood Carr.
Porter Griffin.
Thomas Lee Jr.
Jerry Crabb.
Horace Crabb Sr.
We pour to the names that we hold collectively. Ganga Zumba in Brazil. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe in Haiti. We pour to the great Avengers, Nanny of the Maroons of Jamaica. We pour to the great ancestors, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Say the names that you study. Who are the names of the ancestors that you have come to hold in your heart and your mind as you hope that you can do what they did for us, for your children and children's children? Let's say some of those famous names.
Malcolm X, Muhammad,
John Henry Clark, John Dr. G. Jackson, Muhammad. Jacob Carruthers. And finally, two final libations. We pour to those who make it possible for us to do what we do. We pour to these rangers who stand guardian over this sacred space. We pour to these Africans and these folks who have come from Howard University, the staff, the faculty, the administrators who brought us here today to bear witness. This is not a libation, but an affirmation, because their hearts still beat, their tongues still speak, their minds still think, and their minds still wish the best for us. We pour for all of those people who surrounded us on this journey today and made it possible for us to be here. We pour this affirmation of thanks, Ashe.
Ashe.
And finally, we pour to your children's children's children who will one day stand on this space and speak your name.
Ashe. History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go and what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
I know this for a fact. You don't like how I act. You came up selling crack. You are listening to Elders of Sankofa with host the Elders. The Elders of Sankofa radio broadcast is an affiliate of the Black Reality Think Tank, which operates on the timeforawakening.com radio platform. Reach out to them at Sankofa_think@out.com. All of our programs are archived. Just go to www.timeforawakening.com, access the search portal, and type in the name of the program you desire to review.
Hello, family. This is Brother Kwasi Malimo, government name Horace Kraft, here with you with another show from the Sankofa Council of Elders of Milwaukee. Today, we're going to start off with a quote from Malcolm X. If you are not careful, the newspaper will have you hating the people who are being oppressed and loving the people that are doing the oppressing. And with that said, I'm going to introduce you and talk a little bit about what the show is going to be. We had one of our guests had an emergency where they would not be able to be on tonight, and that's going to be Sergeant Hendricks. But we have former Sergeant of Milwaukee, Pamela Holmes, and then we're going to have Ricky Burns, former detective with Milwaukee. And what we're going to be focusing on is how do we deal with the senseless and unprovoked violence, and police brutality, and killing of Black men, women, and children, and others who see us as an enemy? And what is the accountability in this unjust system, white supremacy? And with that, I'm going to start off with Pamela Holmes. Are you with me?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi. If you could introduce yourself, give a little bio on your background, some of the things that you're doing now, and how you got to this point here.
Okay. So, all right. Let me start by saying my name is Pamela Holmes. I am one of seven children born to Isabel and Elsie Holmes. I was raised up in church with my siblings at Union Hill Missionary Baptist Church, and I received my formal education in the Milwaukee public school system. I attended several grade schools due to the redistricting and integration. Lee Street Elementary, Sharon Day, Seventh-day Adventist, Greenfield Elementary, Hoskins Street School, Twin Cities Street School, and then it became Phillips Wheatley. My middle school was Robert Fulton, and then I graduated from North Division High School in 1986. I went on to further my education at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee from 1987 to 1990, majoring in pre-law and accounting. While attending college and raising two young sons, Eric and Evan Holmes, I decided to place my degree on hold to provide for my children. My new path in life led me to following one of my older brother's footsteps, looking to join the military. Instead, I chose a career in law enforcement. I joined the Milwaukee Police Department in 1992. I faced many challenges in a career dominated by men, white men, more or less, two of which was being Black and being a woman. But I overcame this by simply pressing my way through. I was promoted to sergeant in 2000, and I worked tirelessly at building the bridges between law enforcement and community. I've always had a passion for people and to see the best in everyone. Throughout my later years of service as a police sergeant, I noticed that there was a disconnect between law enforcement and the community, and I, along with several dozen stakeholders, planned an event to try and create dialogue between law enforcement and the community entitled World Peace in August of 2017. During this time, I knew something had to be done, and I was given an opportunity by retired Captain Boris Tsarevich to rebuild the relationship, to make an effect of a torn community from officer shooting in 2016, which resulted in a riot and destruction trust the lives and property of citizens, the officers. So with the support of former County Supervisor Michael Mayo, Michelle Pitts-Luckett, Safe and Sound, Milwaukee County Parks, and many others, this two-day World Peace event was created to engage the community, to give them a different perspective of policing, opening up a much-needed discussion to preserve life, relationships, and property, also raising awareness for homeless teens and veterans. I retired in October 2017 because my empathy and compassion for the community, building those relationships with police, was stifled by my supervisors and placed a strain on what I knew was right and what others perceived as a weakness, which was to engage the community and law enforcement in understanding that there should be no us against them mentality. Before and after retiring from the Milwaukee Police Department, I had been involved with several community service projects, Order of the Eastern Star, Prince Hall, the Daughters of the Exilius, the Ancient Egyptian Arabic Order, Global Mystic Shrine. I've been a chief inspector for the Election Commission. I went back to my high school, North Division, volunteering as an alumni to find out where the disconnect with the children and law enforcement had broken down. I've attended vigils with Peace for Change Alliance, Tracy Dent, one of the community activists for citizens and officers, meeting with community activists, community leaders, faith-based leaders, attorney Michael F. Hupe, the League of Martin, and many other stakeholders, forming the Council of Floyd. Holding Zoom meetings, working on a 21st century model of policing, the Council of Floyd has met several times with Speaker Robin Voss to get bipartisanship, support on education, fair housing, employment, mental health, working capital, and police reform. Currently serve as the president of the National Black Police Association Wisconsin chapter, with the willingness to be of service, standing in the gap to create dialogue with mediation and conflict resolution.
Wow, that's pretty impressive, Pam. I know I see you out there on the streets, and there's a lot of things that you've been doing. And in light of everything that's going on, we just had another killing of unarmed black youth. I think it was Andre Nicholson, and that was at a local bar in the Milwaukee area. I know that wasn't by the police, but that was just another situation in regards to just the violence that goes on. But I know you've been on the department for over 25 plus years, and you're, what you've dealt with in regards to police brutality and so forth, I mean, or how do you look at that? How do you view that? How do you see yourself working the job and also navigating yourself, trying to be that community advocate and a police officer? I mean, was that a difficult task, or how do you see that now and the changes?
Well, back in the day when we were working, during Thanksgiving, Christmas time, the holiday season, there's always an increase, an uptick in robberies, homicides, and things like that. So what we would do is we would put officers out there, because I was a supervisor, so I didn't have to do that anymore, but we would put officers out on the beat and have them do business checks, you know, just checking in on the businesses and the bars and different things like that, doing the tavern check, and that's to have their presence, you know. Presence is everything. You don't have to always go and arrest someone, but if you just show up and people see you, maybe it will deter something from happening. So I don't know if the Milwaukee Police Department at this time, because there's a mass exodus of officers that are retiring, they're leaving, that are happy with the way things are going, and you know, and they're actually fractured. Leadership is poor. Leadership has failed these officers. So when you have this going on, it's hard to try to get out there and, you know, and police and do your job, and you don't know what's what. You got, you know, your job in peril because, you know, you don't have a chief, and then all of a sudden, you know, you have an acting chief, but you have the community that's at you also. So where's the structure? You know, I just wish that we had increased police presence, you know, like we used to during the holiday season, walking the beat or whatever, you know what I'm saying?
Sure.
Especially to, like, because it's during a pandemic as well. So there are some businesses that are still closed. There are some businesses that are open. You know, have the community officers went around to find out who's going to be open after hours, and maybe we can provide police presence or whatever. But when you don't have a foundation and you don't have that leadership at the top, it's easy to just get lost in a
Hey, I just, Ricky just came in, and I'm going to, he's our other guest. So I'm going to let Ricky introduce himself and give a brief background of his history with the Milwaukee Police Department. Ricky?
Sure. Okay, I'm Ricky Burems. I joined the Milwaukee Police Department back in 1982 when Harold Breyer was the police chief. At that time, there were not a lot of black officers. There were not a lot of black supervisors, and then they had the consent decree that said that the city had to hire black officers and promote blacks to supervisory positions. I spent 7 years in uniform. I'm sorry, 8 years in uniform. Then I went 3 years plainclothes drug enforcement. Then I went to the Detective Bureau, where I was a detective for 21 years, including 10 years in homicide. I spent the years in gang, and then the rest mostly violent crimes.
Okay, all right. Thank you, Brother Ricky. I'm going to pose the same question to you in regards to what we're dealing with today in regards to police violence and violence in general in the city. And when I say police violence, I'm talking about the violence against unarmed black people, men, women, and children, unprovoked, that leads to injury or even death. And how do we move forward in this? And what is the accountability with the police? And how do you see us moving forward?
Well, I mean, since I've left the department and I see these incidents occur, I have to say that it's deeply disturbing to me. You know, one of the most disturbing incidents that come to mind is the incidents of the I think the kid was 13 years old, Tamir Rice, who was playing in the park with a toy gun, and the officer pulls up and kills him without even getting out the car, giving the kid a chance, investigating it. And I think that what we're seeing here, you know, first of all, we have to look at the history of policing. Policing is born out of slave catching and the enforcement of Jim Crow laws, the oppression of black people, the restriction of black people. Even if you look at the police badge, and then if you Google photos of slave catcher badges, you'll see that they look similar or either exactly alike. Mm-hmm. But more importantly than that is that the attitudes are the same. What we have here is we have an occupation of the black community. We have white officers who, growing up, never had contact with black people, never built positive relationships with black people, don't know black people, don't know black culture, don't know accurate American history, don't know accurate police history, and they have a fear of black people, especially of young black men. And their idea of the black person coming in is thug, is drug dealer, is criminal, is that they get, they deserve whatever they get. So when you consider that ignorance and that fear, and then you give them power over people in the black community, you know, we get a situation which is what we're seeing now. We're seeing black people abused, killed, not getting adequate police service. And to be honest with you, I don't think that it's going to stop unless we acknowledge the true history of policing and the true history of racism in this country, and then say, you know what, we're going to make a concerted effort, a determined effort to turn the tide and change these things.
Oh, thank you. I mean, that's a lot of information, and that's a lot of truth, and I appreciate you saying that. And I'm just going to go back to Pam. And
Brother Kwasi, this is your family, Dr. James, and we're so excited to get started with this fascinating.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
So happy to have you here, Sergeant Holmes, and Detective Behrens, and you've made reference to the history of policing, and we forgot that we wanted to talk about just some of that history. And we have our Sankofa member, Sister Dee Dee, who had something she wanted to tell us about. But before we get too far past
yes.
that, we want to hear about some of that history. Sister Dee Dee?
Yes, ma'am. I'm here, Dr. James. Good evening, brothers. Good evening. I'm going to talk about the story of New York's first black police officer, told with the help of Langston Hughes and me. All right. Anyway, it is odd that it was Samuel Jesse Battle, the first black police officer in the New York Police Department. It's not a larger part of our city. He was a giant of a man. He was 6'3" and he weighed almost 300 pounds. But of course he was a giant of a man, because when he was born, they say he weighed 16 pounds. His parents were among the last generation, the last generation born in the Southern slavery. And his own birth in 1883 was notable for another benchmark. At 16 pounds, as I said, he was the biggest baby ever recorded in North Carolina. "I guess I always wanted to be large," he said, "and I have been large." Samuel Jesse Battle recalls decades later of how large he was even when he was a baby. But his personal growth was threatened when he was a teenager, he was caught trying to take cash or something from a safe that belonged to his boss, R.H. Smith, a landlord who predicted that within a year the young man would be in prison. That was the turning point of his life, said Battle, who avoided persecution because the boss was a good friend of his father, a Methodist minister. "I said, from that day on, I shall be honest and honorable, and I'm going to make Mr. Smith out of a liar." And he did, thank goodness, which most of our children do, if given a chance. On June 28, 1911, a century ago Tuesday, Samuel Battle largely delivered on his restitution. Having grown to be 6'3" and 285 pounds, he became the first black person appointed to New York City's police force. He would go on to become the first black sergeant in 1926, right on, the first black lieutenant in 1935, and the city's first black parole commissioner in 1941. All right, Brother Kwesi, I'm going to let you take it because it's a lot.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that history and so forth. Well, I really appreciate that. Sister Pam.
Yeah.
On the department, the things that you've witnessed and so forth, prior to you becoming a sergeant, and did you ever break up any things that you felt that were unjust, how they were treating people in? Or
well,
did you ever witness anything or have to write anybody up? And how does that work?
Okay.
We see the accountability just doesn't seem like it's there, like it's that much of a factor, I mean, that just keeps repeating over and over again.
So I was trained by some of the best people coming up. Elijah Williams, who just passed away from COVID. And
sorry to hear that.
Yes. Fred Jones was my FTO, Jorgensen was my FTO, and Dwight Lovett, and Tony Hendricks, working with those officers, and, you know, John Dorsey, and the value of people that they instill in you into doing the right thing, And, you know, I grew up in 17th Right. That's my neighborhood where I came from. And when you see the officers, how they would come around and how they harass the kids in the neighborhood, or, you know, they beat them up or whatever, you know, the police brutality and all the stuff like that. I said, you know what? That's what I want to do. I want to join the Milwaukee Police Department so I can stop this. How can I be a part of that? Because my first initial thing was to become an attorney so I can represent these people. But mm-hmm. trying to figure out before I do that, how could I figure out what police was doing before I start representing people? So I said, I'll become one. And so I became a law enforcement officer. Then I found out that I was needed in law enforcement more so than I was being an attorney. And yes, I've seen a lot of different things. I've seen officers, you know, get to the scene and, you know, a prisoner wasn't injured before, now they're injured. And so I made it my business, even before I got promoted, if we were in a pursuit or if there was a foot chase or vehicle pursuit, that I would try to get to the end of that call, you know, try to at the end of the chase before the rest get there. Some of them are heavy-handed, and some of them, you know, that adrenaline gets to running and pumping, and while you run, and it turns into something else that they did not expect, didn't want to happen. And so I always made it my business, even after I got promoted, to get to the end of the chase and to cut things out. One particular time, it was like some guy had ran and he fled from the officers. It was cold outside. It was winter time, and we were looking for him, and we found, he ran away with handcuffs on, but we found him. And when we got him, we walked him to the officers walked him to the squad car, put him inside the back of the wagon, and the officer that lost custody of him, and he's just like walking down the sidewalk like a madman. Watching him, and I'm looking, I'm like, okay, don't do nothing stupid. Don't do nothing. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
What is he going to say? So he opens the door, and I'm thinking he's going to say something like, you know, you thought you got away from us, and we got you. He gets inside, and the van starts rocking, literally. And I'm like, wow. Oh, my God. So I'm like, get him. I said, get him out of there. And they pulled him out, and he looked at me, and he said, Sarge, I'm sorry, Sarge. He effing pissed me off. I said, you can't never let nobody push you off to the level of passivity where you can put hands on somebody and injure them and hurt them, and they're already in handcuffs. So not only is that, like, you know, that's excessive force, because the person is, he can't fight back. He can't defend himself. Right. Once handcuffs go on, the fighting stops. There's no special need. And the fact that he got away from you, well, maybe you should have had control of him from the beginning. So... yes, there's been plenty of times where I've come across that, and I took action. I woke people up, and some people were a part of the Frank Jude incident, wound up getting fired. Some of them went to jail. And, you know, you have those, like, little warning signs at the beginning, and he's going to hurt somebody one day, and you write them up. But you have these, your bosses that's there, it's like, oh, we'll take care of it. But, you know, mysteriously, some of those reports left the system, you know, because I wrote those people anyway, but nothing happened with them. And then all of a sudden, they're paying out millions of dollars to Frank Jude.
Right. You know, so. Well, Ricky, I'm sure you've experienced or witnessed some things. Or how were you treated? You know, you were also a detective and so forth. And as you moved up in the ranks and so forth, I mean, what did you witness? How did they treat you? And did you see the type of violence that was unfair to anyone, and more so even people that look like us?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that I knew Sergeant Holmes when she was on the street, and in my opinion, she was the best. I mean, second to none. And you know what she's saying is true and accurate. You would see a lot of violence being perpetrated, you know, by white officers, and even sometimes by black officers against you know, black prisoners who have been handcuffed. But for me, being a detective, there's another aspect that I was witness to, and that was the violation of the rights of black people as far as having their homes entered without a search warrant or without probable cause, and you know, officers going in and violating the domiciles, and, you know, tearing their houses up, terrorizing their kids, people being arrested without probable cause, you know, people being charged with things that they shouldn't be charged with. And, you know, people are aware of the things that the police department does, but I just want to say that the district attorney's office, who decides, you know, what to charge people with is even worse, because they don't have to answer to anybody. And it is true what Pam said. The issue is that there is no ethics or integrity in the ranks of the police department as you go towards the top. You can see an officer do something wrong and make a complaint against them, and before you know it, you're being targeted, you know, just because you had the audacity to speak out against something that was wrong. One of the worst cases that I dealt with, you know, being a detective, is that a young lady was brutally killed, and then years later, with advances in DNA technology, we found a suspect whose blood was mixed with her blood on her clothing. It was inside of her shoe. This guy was had already been arrested for two sexual assaults, and the DA refused to charge him, even though, I spoke with the FBI about the case, and they said, hey, this guy should be on death row. This case is a slam dunk. But they never notified this lady's family and said, hey, you know, we have a suspect. Have you ever heard of this guy? Do you know this guy? Have you ever seen this guy with the victim? But they did use the case as what's called a clearance. They said this case is solved. And the significance of that is that you can use a solved case to boost the homicide clearance rate and give the illusion that the Detective Bureau is doing a great job solving cases, but this guy was never, ever brought to justice. And when I started to raise a complaint, they took a promotion away from me. They took me off of the violent crimes unit and put me on the entry-level detective position, and they planted marijuana in my squad car. So, I mean, the retaliation is real, and you have to be brave, and you have to kind of be willing to put yourself on the line if you step out of the norm and speak out against things that are wrong.
I'm going to say I used to be a police officer as well. I was in the city of Cudahy, and I got in trouble several times because I physically stopped officers that were taking advantage of people that were handcuffed, or even people that just was more of them, and they just did some hurtful and harmful things to them. But I guess one other thing I wanted to touch on, not just police, but I've been told with the fire department, I know it's happened with us when I've been on calls, a lot of times when they go to homes, and especially Black people's homes, if there's some type of alarm, or maybe a fire, or not a fire, or they just get a disturbance call where they're there, they do more damage than was necessary. I mean, I've heard about that happens in Milwaukee. Can any of you guys elaborate on that?
I know exactly what you're talking about. And that, the fire department can do unbelievable damage with those axes and with the tools that they have. So, what I've seen is them, I mean, they'll tear holes in the walls. They'll tear holes in the roof. When it really was not necessary, it's almost like they're practicing. And you can see a difference between the way that they treat white people and Black people, or rich people and poor people. It's like they treat, Black people or poor people as being less than human. And again, they have a certain amount of power over Black people and poor people, and they exercise that power in dark and evil ways. I've seen that myself. You're absolutely right.
Pam, have you ever witnessed or seen anything like that, or is that something you know about?
As far as the fire, just rephrase, ask me the question again about the fire department damaging
property. Sometimes when they go, Yeah, sometimes just damaging property, just adding more stress onto a stressful situation when they go to a home. And a lot of times it doesn't warrant that this wall be torn down and so forth and this and that, but sometimes they will do it. And I've heard of that from so many people and so forth, whereas they'll do so much, the least amount of damage for this person in this situation. But when they get to a lot of these places, especially predominantly black homes in the inner city, they put a lot of these people in a bad situation and so forth on a financial end.
So then I have seen when the fire department, not to say destroy homes, but for lack of a better term, destroy the home. But they're actually, the part that I've been involved with when I've seen them do that is I was actually inside of one of the houses. And, after they put the fire out and you go through with the, the detective that comes for
right.
to him. And it's like, we're standing there and I'm like, why is there smoking over there in the corner? It was a part that had never been burnt. It hadn't been touched by fire. So there wasn't a dark space over there. Like they said, the darkest spot where the, is where the fire started is what they'll tell you. And so, and I'm looking over in the corner and said, but why is it smoking over there? And it's like, I don't know. So we have the fire department, fire department come back in. And they go to whacking at the wall, and there's a flame in the wall. You know what I'm saying? So I yeah. get it, but I have not been on that end that Ricky is talking about, where I have seen them just to destroy that. But just speaking from my experience and being at those calls, for the arson investigators, is to actually see something look, like they are getting ready to pack up and leave, and it's safe for us now to go through the house. And I'm kind of like, why is it smoking over there in the corner? And come to find out, it's just like a spark that was in the wall, So I've seen that.
Now, why is it, do you think, that we don't have many people, or are there people, I'll say like a whistleblower, people of color, or even white officers that don't like what's going on, the brutality and the harmful things? I mean, I've talked to so many white officers, and they would tell me, that you never, never admit a wrong. I don't care what the, and that's one of the things that they get, they were mad about with, I think it was Chief Flynn, when he made a statement in regards to Dante Hamilton, and he said that the officer had made a mistake during that pat down, and they gave him a lot of, complaints in regards to that. But that was something that is that you never admit a wrong. And I've heard that so many times. Is that the common thought?
Well, let me respond to that. I think that goes back to the history of policing in that, one thing about, being trained and conditioned as a police officer, they talk about the blue line. It is true that we are trained and conditioned to depend on each other, to protect each other. I mean, it takes a police officer to understand a police officer's life. And I think that it's kind of human nature. But, being a police officer, you're supposed to do what's right, and you're supposed to stand for what's right. The problem comes in when police officers start to do what's wrong, and other police officers do that, and then they start to have moral dilemmas. Should I tell? Should I keep my mouth shut? And then, when officers do have the courage to tell, again, instead of being commended or encouraged, they are discouraged, they are punished, they are transferred, they are moved, they're ostracized, they don't get backup anymore, they're put out there by themselves. So, it is wrong when an officer says, well, we never tell the truth, even if we do something that's wrong. But the actions of police departments create that the breeding ground for that sort of conduct, because that you see so many officers that are not punished for doing wrong. I mean, thank God for video, because without video, we wouldn't have Rodney King. I guarantee that those officers would have just said, well, he resisted arrest. We wouldn't have George Floyd, the same thing. Oh, he just resisted arrest. any of these incidents that we see on video, if they were not on video, all of the officers would jump on the bandwagon and say, well, that person resisted arrest, that person tried to take our gun, that person was fighting, and we would have no proof otherwise. So, you know, officers have to start having the courage to speak out. And then on the flip side, the departments have to start immediately firing and charging these officers with wrongdoing. It doesn't take 3, 4, 5, 6 months to charge an officer for doing something that was obviously wrong. Just like Deputy Chief Malik Aziz from the Dallas Police Office said, the video is not going to change. I mean, it's right there on video. What's going to change? If you see the officer on video doing something wrong, fire him and charge him. And that will let these other officers know, well, you know, if I do this, I'm going to face some consequences. And right now we're not seeing that. We're not seeing officers face consequences for things that even a normal citizen would face consequences for.
Thank you, Ricky. I think we're coming up on our first break in about a minute. So when we come back, I'd like to also talk about applied immunity. Is that something you think that's keeping police officers from moving forward? And again, how do we deal with them with this violence and so forth? I mean, you know, some people say, hey, we got to fight back. We got to do, I mean, I'm not letting anybody hurt me or my family unjust and so forth and this and that. What is a righteous man to do?
Brother, I'd like to take this opportunity to, before we go to our next segment, is our sponsor is eDoc Advice, and it is a website created to provide a place to go to get answers to your health or medical concerns. The questions are answered by health professionals and those who are knowledgeable about helping you make decisions about your personal health that makes sense to you. So we're encouraging our sponsor is eDoc Advice, and you'd go to www.edocadvice.com. That's our sponsor. And we'll hear more from them in the second segment.
Thank you, Dr. James. Mr. Pam?
Yes.
All right. I said we were going to talk about applied immunity.
Okay.
And, you know, how do you see that? You know, for officers, again, in situations and so forth, you know, is that what makes them feel invincible and so forth, how things are being handled?
Are we on a break or are we at least?
That's something, we can go over that after the break.
Okay, that's cool.
plugs it in. Perfect.
We'll start the car. I need a tap to begin the scan. Now, my $2,000 scan tool said it was a catalytic converter. Let's see what this little device does for us.
Wow, incredible. Same reading.
Here's your time for an awakening media lineup. Monday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives, with host Brother Oshi, Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., same time, same place. Continued Monday lineup, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., Acres of Diamonds, with host Brother Jihad Ahmed, 8 p.m. to 9 p.m., Black Therapy Central, host Dr. Mawia Kambom and Sister Nataki Kambom, 9 p.m. till 10 p.m., Conversation Reparations, first and third Mondays. On Tuesday, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m., Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers. On Thursday, 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., Melanin Live with host Lance Jones, co-host Boniswa Ayan. Fridays, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m., Time for an Awakening, with creator of Time for an Awakening and host, Brother Elliot, co-hosted by Brother Richard. Saturday, 4 p.m. till 6 p.m., Black Sister Talk, with host Wanda Chambers. 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., The Elders of Sankofa. And Sunday, 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., Time for an Awakening, host Brother Elliot and co-host Brother Richard. Check us out, get informed, and get involved.
You are listening to Elders of Sankofa with host The Elders. The Elders of Sankofa radio broadcast is an affiliate of the Black Reality Think Tank, which operates on the timeforawakening.com radio platform. Reach out to them at Sankofa_think@out.com. All of our programs are archived. Just go to www.timeforawakening.com, access the search portal, and type in the name of the program you desire to review.
Brother Kwasi, we're getting ready for our listeners who may be there with questions or comments. And the call is 215-490-9832.
All right. Caller, are you listening or do you have any questions? Would you like to ask any questions?
I have a question.
Go ahead, sir.
Hello? Yes.
Yes, my name go ahead. We can hear you.
Oh, good, good. My name is Charles Robinson, and I'd like to, first of all, thank and acknowledge the two wonderful people who served as police officers, serving and protecting our community over the years. And I know their commitment. I've been in a few meetings with them and got a chance to meet them. And my
two?
Question, well, you know, Brother Horace, you went over.
No, that's okay. That's okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, but some of my best friends are police officers, you know, including, you probably know Johnson Flora. I went to high school with Johnson, and he was on the football team with us. Big old country boy. And,
all right.
Every time I would see him in the street, he would always tell his partner and people that I threw him his first touchdown for the football team at Richard King. Yeah, and then, you know, we had Dewey Russ. He was captain. I think he was the first black captain. And his family grew up, we grew up in the same neighborhood. And Charles Grisham, was the captain over at 5th District, and Uriel Jordan was a good officer. We called him Rookie when I was a kid growing up over on the playground around the Follett playground. And he got to know everybody. In fact, he followed me to one of my basketball games one night after stopping me. He almost made me late. And I was so angry at him. And then during the game, I looked over at the exit, and he was standing at the exit. He actually came to the game to see me play. I guess I didn't know if he was, you know, investigating me to see if I was telling the truth when I told him I was on my way to a basketball game or what. But I think he was that kind of person. He just showed up because he was a part of the community. Mm. But my question is, in regards to police, you know, community relations, we have a lot of work to do. And back in 1979, I had a case before the Fire Police Commission, and I was one of the few people who actually prevailed before the Fire and Police Commission. And back during that time, it was Harold Breyer. And my case made the Fire and Police Commission's rules and policies binding on the chief. Before that, he was like a dictator. He could do whatever he wanted to do. And then in 1995, we trained officers at the academy in conflict resolution, the first time non-officers trained officers at the academy. Tony Courtney was with us and about 10 other psychologists who worked for MPS. And we were training peer mediators at the time we got together, because we wanted to do something about all those drive-by shootings. We had 146 homicides back during between 1991 and 93. And then in 2017, I was a part of Passage United, and we monitored the scenario training at the academy. And so I got to see a lot of these officers, and there were a few bad ones. Most of them were good, of course. And I see possibility and community police relations, especially if we can work together through, you know, with the block club, the schools, the churches, and the neighborhood stations together. I see that if they could operate as a unit in those neighborhoods, then perhaps we can have a better future. I just wanted to throw that question out to the wonderful people you're interviewing right now.
Okay. Sister Pam, you want to have at that one at first?
You have Ricky go ahead, and then I come in.
Okay, Ricky.
Wait a minute. What is the specific question?
Well, if we could operate as a unit, if we could have the kind of relationships where block clubs and schools and churches and the neighborhood district station, if they could operate as a unit in those areas, is that possible?
Okay, yeah. I would love to comment on that. I'm gonna answer your question by making this statement. In my 32 years as a police officer and as a detective, never have I had a success or been able to make a case by myself. It was always based on my ability to go into the community and make someone feel comfortable enough and safe enough to give me information to do my job. Without that, I would not have had any success. And, you know, that ability and that desire is based on love of the community, love of my people, and an understanding of what they are going through, including an understanding that good people do bad things, and that people who commit criminal acts are still people and have people that love them and care about them. And, you know, sometimes they were just put in a bad situation, or they grew up in a type of environment that made them more predatory. Now, I understand that. And I never held it against somebody, you know, because they were involved in criminal activity, because I understand it. I understand that it's wrong and that it's counterproductive. But if the police and the community are ever to come together
they have to start, they have to stop viewing each other as adversaries. There is no way in the world that any police department can be successful without the help of the community. You know, one of the main problems is that there are a great many police officers and the police officials who view the community as adversaries, who view the people in the community as bad. There was an assistant police chief who would say frequently that we need to call in an airstrike on the hood and blow the whole thing up and start all over again. And I mean, he would say this repeatedly because this is what he believed. Now, the problem is that this guy is a leader on the police department, and that attitude is infecting the subordinates of the police department. So you're absolutely right, sir. The police, the community, the schools, you know, government agencies, employment entities, all need to come together to make our city a better, more productive and safe environment. That goes without saying.
Mr. Pam?
So we didn't accept the $9.7 million from the federal government, I guess. I heard on the news yesterday because it was earmarked for the police department, and the representatives, you know, they're advocating defund the police. But, you know, I have a lot of friends on the force, like Elijah Williams, his family, we grew up together on 7th Lane, and they were some of the nicest people, you know, on the planet. And if I ever saw him on the street or Johnson, you know, these are my friends. But, you know, now things have changed so bad that it looks like we're being occupied by a foreign force when police officers don't have to live in the community anymore. They could come in from the suburbs and you know, just surveil us and occupy our territory. That's the way it seems right now.
Brother Quasi, I want you to know that Officer Malone is now on, and also you have a caller at 215-924. If they're there and they have a comment or a question, they're waiting.
Good evening, everyone. I'm listening to the show for the first time. My name is Brother Joe from Philadelphia, and I first want to know what's the name of the show. I'm a first time listener to this particular show, and I'm gonna be a regular listener now. But I just want to know what's the name of the show and the name of the host and everything.
This is the Black Reality Think Tank, and this show is featuring on the crisis in policing. My name is Brother Kwasi Malimo, government name Horace Kraft. Our guests are retired officers from the Milwaukee Police Department. We have Sergeant Pamela Holmes and former Detective Ricky Burns.
Okay. But again, and this is Brother Joe, and I listen to this network. The shows I've had to listen to on this network, it's been, of course, Time from the Wake with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard and what's the other brother show? Brother, what's the brother come on show? Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, Brother. What's the name of his show? You know what I'm talking about. Yeah, I'm getting a senior moment. But anyway, yeah, I listen to his show as well. But I'm a first time listening to this show, and I love the information that's given out, because as a 59-year-old Black man, I tell you, I've seen a lot of bad experiences in this city with white police officers, you know, and even some ignorant, self-hating Black police officers doing stuff to our people that's been just outrageous and stuff. And see, what get me out of here, these white police officers, especially this bigot police union chief in this town in Philadelphia, John McNesby, who's the head of the local FOP, when they ever to kill Black men and the deadly force and stuff in cases where it's not even deadly force is necessary, he always justified with saying, you know, there's movies and stuff, they gotta shoot center mass. And I'm saying myself, right here in Philadelphia, it's been cases. That's why I say white cops do what they want to do when it's to their own people. It's been cases right here in Philadelphia. And I know I lived it, nobody can tell me, because I've experienced them, where white police officers, where white boys shooting at them, threatening them, doing all kinds of stuff, and they'll shoot him in his arm or his leg and stuff. For them, deadly force for one of them, only when it's absolutely other avenues been exhausted, then they'll use deadly force. But they try, they even shoot the car tires out. They do all kinds of stuff to avoid killing their own people. But a black man can have mental problems or whatever, and first thing they do, like they did with Brother Walter Wallace here a few months ago, blow you away in a minute. They have shot black men in this town, mentally problem. Enough to get Wendell Washington Charlie. He was a black man. He was like a homeless guy. He did like a lot of odd jobs for people. He used to drink and stuff like that. But he wasn't a violent person. They shot that man. I'm going back almost 25 years. They shot that man like 160 something times. An older black man gets rid of his body with bullets. I mean, this stuff happens time and time again. But like I said, white boys could be up in their face threatening them. They'd be up in their personal space. And when they shoot them, like I said, a lot of times they shoot them just to wound them in the leg or the arm, or they try to, you know, de-escalate the situation. But with us, they don't do that with us. They kill us in a heartbeat, you know. I mean, it's just outrageous the stuff that goes on, man, you know.
Well, that's one of the things that we're trying to do. We're trying to figure out how we move forward in this situation. There's so many of us that are witnessing and being victimized by this type of behavior, and not just police, just violence in general and so forth.
Yes.
So how do we move forward today?
Yes, indeed.
I thank you for your call, brother.
You're more than welcome. And can you put me on mute so I can listen to the rest of the show?
Yeah, repeat, sir?
Can you put me on mute so I can listen to the rest of the show?
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Danes, you got that?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I have a point that I'd like to bring up along these lines. In the last 40 years that I've been in my career, I've observed a lot more of us in other areas. Policing would be an example, where over the 40 years, there are many of us who have been promoted and have advanced in our areas. And I think that there is really the time now where we have enough people who have been part of the ranks, part of the system, that some of our organizations that we formed should be available to the members so that they can have a place to bring some of the observations that they've noted during the course of their work. If they're seeing a lack of diversity in officers in the community, or if they're noticing that people were handled improperly, that group should be able to receive those types of calls and be able to get provide advice to those persons who ordinarily would be powerless as an individual, but coming from a organized group representing the membership, not your unions, per se, but I know that most of the organizations do have some representation, and then they begin to discuss what are some ways within the system to address how some of these things are handled. And I think that what's troubled me is that as we have gotten more power, so to speak, we have been promoted, that we become part of the system rather than being part of the system, but also serve in a capacity to try to problem solve so that their organization is operating in a position of integrity. And so you can't do that very often, or we couldn't do it maybe as well 40 years ago, but at the stage that we are now, there are enough individuals, I would say, who have these leadership positions and should be able to have more of a voice, particularly many of them may be retired, and they are able to speak in a way that maybe they could not have while they were actively working, but now their voice should have some meaning.
Well, you know, that's again what we have with these two guests we have, and also myself, being a former police officer. You know, I spoke out on the job, and so did our two guests, and I know so many other people have. And, it, you know, I think that's just going to be a situation that we're, you know, in time. But I think we already know that, you know, it's about power, and they're not going to give up their power. So I don't think there's a whole lot. I'm not being the type of person to say we give up. I'm saying that we just need to be our own people. I mean, we didn't have these problems when we, you know, got our freedom and stuff like that in the 1800s and so forth. And you know, we had our Black Wall Street and so forth. And then they came and took it, but so we didn't know it was a depression and things going on. So no matter what we do, they got to come in and they got to take and disrupt and so forth and that. So at what point, you know, are we going to stop saying, let's come together, whereas they don't want us to be together. And I'm okay. We're not asking Muslims, Jews, and so they got their own churches, language, so forth, this and that. We didn't come with any of that here. You know, so we don't have a lot of our identity and so forth coming here and stuff like that. So we've been indoctrinated into this European way of thinking and doing and stuff, and we have to move from that and get to our African ways and so forth to make a better decision of how we go forward. You know, we don't have to be together. We can still be on yourself. I think Malcolm X. And Marcus Garvey, you know, spoke on that, among others. Yeah. I'm going to go with Sister Pam. I think we didn't have you answer on that from Brother Charles. Okay. Pam, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay.
I'm there. I'm here. So one of the things that needs to happen, so back in 2017, like I said during my introduction, describing my bio, who I am, and what I was involved with, is that these activists, these kids are awake. They're no longer babies. They're not going anywhere. And a lot of them do not know how to speak or get it out, what they're trying to say. So it always comes off abrasive and angry. So I was invited by Boris Tushnevich to kind of go to one of the community meetings. I worked day shifts and to stay after to go to one of the community meetings and kind of like listen to what was going on, because he wanted to know where there was the disconnect at. What was he missing? So I sat and I went with him and I sat and I listened. I paid my overtime, my 4 hours or what have you. And when we got back to the station, I basically told him, I said, you guys are not listening to each other. I said, you're yelling at them and telling them what they should do from a police standpoint, and they're telling you what they can and cannot do from a citizen standpoint, and you're not compromising. You're not meeting them halfway. And there is the disconnect right there, because you just can't come in and say you got to do X, Y, Z, and this is the way it's going to be done. Or you want the kids to play in the park, but you want them reading books. Well, maybe that's the way you raise your kids, but you have to look at things differently. You know, within the area that they've grown up in, you know, what they know, what they've learned. So one of the things I did was, like I said, I was given free rein to try to build the bridges. And, you know, after the 2016 riot, and I brought, you know, just talking to some of these here people in the community and just trying to see, and just from just years of service and knowing what's going on, you know, with the sex trafficking and things like that. So
sure.
I contacted someone within human trafficking, so to Milwaukee. For everything that I had going on, it was keeping our kids safe from human trafficking and bullying, and dialogue about what to do when stopped by police and knowing your rights. For every seminar or introduction or a person who was going to speak, I had someone from the community and someone from the police department. So for, you know, for the human trafficking, I had a sensitive crimes officer. Then I had someone else from the community that would take care of the Daniel Patterson. And I believe it was Martha Love that they take care of sex trafficking and things like that. And I will always have somebody paired up with them. So then that way, what we're doing is we're transferring information from law enforcement to the community. The community is giving it back to us. And it's opening up these dialogues that we so desperately need. Because right now, it's like when you don't have those things that's going on and you're trying to, as a law enforcement officer, you see what's needed and you know what they need. And it's kind of like, how do I tell them without them thinking that I'm trying to trick them? And, you know, they probably think I'm trying to trick them to arrest them or something like that when I'm really trying to give them information. So one of the things with the world peace, you know, what it did was kind of like it allowed the law enforcement to bring the, you know, the awareness to the community, you know, and, you know, just the knowledge of even selling water on the corner. Why can't you sell water? Instead of taking some kid's cooler and ice, the water and everything else and dumping it out and giving them a ticket, why don't you tell them where they need to go and get the license to peddle? And that way right. They're legit. And they can go to Walgreens, CVS and say, hey, I want to purchase my water out of your store. Do you mind if I sell it on the corner for $1 so I can buy, you know, get ready for school, get me some school supplies or something like that, help my mom out or something like that. So, yes, the relationships can be worked upon. It's going to take somebody with the empathy and passion to do it. That's the difference. You know, you have some officers out there that really want to help. And when you out there and you really want to help, what they do to you is they transfer you from one place, like Risa Kane and Kim Foster and Linda Reed. Those, they were all in community services. But what happened? They transferred them all out and sent them to different districts because they were making a difference, you know, in the community. So, when you have people that have a passion, and that's one of the reasons why I retired, because it's kind of like you get tired of chasing people, honestly.
Right.
It's like, I don't want to go to work today and have to chase nobody down. Let me do something. I got 25 years old. Let me do something I want to enjoy now. That's going out there and trying to meet with the people, to network with the people, to, if I can offer them a service, if I can tell them which way to go, the best way to go about doing it. It's not always about arresting people. It can't be. So what's wrong with giving them the information, the much needed information that they need on what to do? If you hear or know of any job openings, give them that information as well. We even had a job resource fair. Sharitha King is a retired officer, and what she owned Express Drug Screening. She was the owner of that company. And what I had her do with job interviews is I have her come and I said, I need you to do on-site drug screening. So I don't want these people to have to wait. People are coming to try to get employed. You know, gainfully employed. And what always prohibits or, you know, knocks them off is they have to go and get the drug test done.
Sure.
You know,
and did they have to pay for that, or was that something that the employees paid for?
Everything was free. She absorbed it. So she provided that service for free to them. And, you know, basically the conversation is, don't have me test you if you know you're going to test positive. That, you know, don't even waste the test is what she's saying. And you know, that's a lot right now. You smell half these kids walking around, not just black kids, there's white kids too, and Hispanic. The smell of weed, the stench is just horrible. You know what I mean? It's like a lot want good jobs, but you have to be able to qualify. You have to be able to pass a drug test to get those good jobs. So it's a lot of work to be done. I mean, I'm up for the task of building bridges between law enforcement and community. I love being in policing. I love being of service. And at the same time, you know, trying to help, if I can just help someone. My pastor always said, if I can just help someone, you know, Reverend Turner, you know, when I was growing up.
Now, some of the other things that you did, you also meet other departments as an ambassador, so to speak, but you didn't do that for the Milwaukee Police Department. You did that on your own during your time with the police department, as far as traveling to different countries to see how they did their policing and how was their experiences for you.
Right. Yeah. So I'm a member of the National Black Police Association, and it's across the United States, Canada, England, Bermuda, Jamaica. And basically what it is that every year the conference is in a different state, and Black officers in England, you're either white or colored. So you have Arab officers and, you know, people that are not white who consider themselves they're either Black or they're white. And they show up to these conferences, and to network with them, to just listen to how they treat and the things, you know, treat the people in the community, the things that they do, it just, you just leave that conference feeling so empowered. Like, when I get back home, I'm going to try this. When I get back home, I'm going to do that. And you try to get back home, and you take, you know, you pick up all these pamphlets and these little discs that they have, the CDs or whatever, and you just want somebody to look at it to see what you've seen and say, hey, we can change this. We can do something great. We can rebuild our community, you know, just by reaching out to the people and offering the services to show them that it's not an us against them mentality. Well, of course, that's just me, you know, and I kind of just fell on deaf ears, but every year I just look forward to going to the conference to networking with those officers to find out what they are doing in their community, that they're making a difference and that they're changing lives. You know what I mean? So they feed the homeless. I know we
hear now, but in some places in England, they don't carry guns.
Some places, yes.
And what is the crime stats on in that situation? You know,
the thought behind, okay, so I can tell you what I know. The thought behind Bobby's or whatever not carrying firearms is that they would have that much crime. So if they were to have guns, then people would be like, the citizens would know that they're armed, and then it would probably want to challenge them. So what they did was they're not armed. The only people that are armed is like the people that's guarding the queen or the castle or something like that. You know, the government basically. But for the most part, a lot of them they're just not armed at all.
And do you feel that they're well respected? I mean, that's what I hear a lot of, but is that true to your thinking and knowledge?
Yes, to my knowledge, yes. And then you may hear some of the instances where they have like a terrorist attack, and they'll say somebody got, you know, killed or something like that, and you know and they know these officers don't have weapons, so that's the point, is kind of like, why are you killing the cop when you know he or she is not armed? And I think some people have mental health issues, and at the same time, it's making a statement as well as, you know, like some type of terrorist attack or something like that, where they're trying to send the message to law enforcement as well, which is unfortunate.
Well, you know, I think another thing that's pretty unfortunate is they've been making it seem like police are under great attack. Well, they're being asked to be accountable for their actions and how they've been treating people, and that's been since the beginning. But I guess what the other thing that we're looking at is when a law enforcement officer is killed in the line of duty. And when you look at the stats, and you know, and the funny thing about FBI stats is that every city is not involved in FBI stats when they put them out there. But I would say from FBI stats, the mid 80s were probably your highest time for a law enforcement officers to die within a year's time. You had up to 50 to high 40s. Within the last several, I'll say from 1990 to with a spike in, I think it was 2011, and it might have been 40 something officers, but the numbers are extremely low, and they put it out there like, you know, they're putting their lives on the line every day, you know, that this is a bloodbath that they're going through. And how do you see that? I mean, what are your thoughts on that? I'll go with Ricky on that.
Well, when you look at the amount of law enforcement officers being killed and you compare it to the amount of citizens being killed, there really is not a comparison. I mean, being a law enforcement officer, I mean, it hurts my heart, you know, when I see a law enforcement officer be killed. But also being a Black man who lives in a Black community, it hurts my heart when I see a Black person being killed.
I think that as a whole, if the police department cultivated a more positive relationship with the community, officers, incidents of officers being hurt or killed will go down tremendously. And also, there's something called officer-created jeopardy, where officers put them, they walk into a situation and they exacerbate the situation and make it worse and make it a situation where they can be or many times are killed. So, you know, if they're more tactical and more strategic in their approach, again, a lot of these killings would subside. Of course, there are situations where, you know, officers are ambushed and there's nothing that they can do. But there's just something else that I want to comment on about the criminal justice system in general, and that being that police officers, district attorneys, government officials are making income, buying houses, cars, putting their kids through college, making good livings based on the misery of Black people. So they really don't have an incentive to change the system. They don't have the insight to realize that if they cultivate the talents of Black people, because you see a Black child and you see how brilliant, how smart they are, then they go through the school system, and by the time that they're in the sixth or seventh, sometimes even the third or fourth grade, they become so disenchanted. They've lost so much of their self-esteem. They're made to feel so small that they don't feel like they have any power over their lives. So a lot of them become disinterested in school and they go to the streets. You know, but the powers that be don't see that if I water this seed, if I cultivate this flower, the contributions that they would make to the community are unimaginable. And that, you know, the way that I benefit financially from keeping my foot on these people's necks would pale in comparison to what it would be if I would allow these people, being Black people, being poor people, if I would allow them to flourish. They just don't have the insight. And of course, a lot of them, and it is the truth, I hate to say it, but a lot of them just do not care. They like the system just the way it is because they benefit at the expense of a large group of people in our society, being Black people, poor people. But it's wrong and it's counterproductive, but for them, it's just fine the way it is.
And, you know, Brother Ricky, I think that they do see the talent and the ability and a lot of the Black people around the world and so forth and this and that. But I think that this system is designed to keep them in a place where they, because it's all about greed and power, and they're not going to give that up. And you're not going to share the wealth. That's just my feeling on that, and I just don't think that that's looking to change. Pam?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, no, I thought you were saying something or wanted to comment on that.
No.
Okay.
You wanted me to comment on it? You asking me?
Sure.
Please do, Pam.
Please.
Okay, just give me the question again. Because I was listening to Ricky.
Yeah, just the way that, you know, the system, I'll put it simply. On a police department, you make a lot of money working overtime. And, sure. And you work overtime, you know, by arresting people and doing the reports where, you know, sometimes you really might not have had to make that arrest. You really might not have to aggravate that situation where it got to the point where numerous officers had to respond and numerous officers are getting paid, you know, based on something that you instigated. So So what I'm saying is that, you know, the criminal justice system, being it police officers, district attorneys, they are making livings off of the miseries of Black people. Look at prison. Prison is not about rehabilitation. It's
right.
not about,
exactly.
Giving prisoners the skills to, you know, get good jobs and become better people. It's a revolving door. It's prison is built up to keep you in prison, let you out a little while, watch you make a mistake again, and then come back to prison. And it's cheap labor. It's like modern day slavery. And again, the powers that be don't realize that if you cultivate this person, if you allow them to become skilled technically and make positive contributions to society, that our society would grow exponentially. A lot of people in positions of powers don't care. They enjoy keeping Black people oppressed and repressed, and they don't want to give up the power or what they believe is the power that they have over Black people and over poor people, because they are prospering from these practices.
What do you say to that, Pam?
Okay, so basically, in response to what Ricky was just saying just now, is that it takes a good boss. I'm not tooting my own horn, but you know who your people are that's milking overtime. Some people who
right.
don't go east of the river until it's 7:30, mm-hmm. up at 8 o'clock or 11 o'clock, and then they know mm-hmm. they're gonna find somebody that's driving around, you know, with no tags. That's the first sign of a traffic stop. No license plate. You know what I'm saying, on the car, or the tail lights
right.
is out. Small. And then they give them a mountain load of tickets. So that's when we used to have that quota system. You know, here you had to have so many tickets every day or within a month, and they got rid of that. And that generated some people a lot of revenue, and they would just write mountainous tickets. And then at the end of the night, they would try to stay over while I'm writing citations. Now, it got to the point where it was like they were killing the budget. So whereas you could not, if you wanted to do a violent crimes reduction, you know, from 7 p.m. to 7 to 3, 7 p.m. to 3 a.m., you know, for bar closing times, you know, people going to the bars or nightlife or whatever, we had to wind up getting grants because they were killing the budget with that. But it takes a good boss to be like, hey, what you got going on? All right, you can do that tomorrow at work. And you cut that, you stop all of that, and you cut into their, I'm not trying to say cut into their pockets, but you can write the ticket later. And then it got to the point where we had to do something different with the tickets because people were coming in complaining. I got a ticket in the mail. They could no longer mail out citations without having a supervisor review it. You got to at least first attempt to give the person the citation. And then if you could not, you had to go and get a boss to sign off on it to say that they watched you try and they seen you try. And you
yeah.
have to record the dates and the times that you tried to write us to serve that person the citation before you were able to send it off. So that cut down on a lot of the things that they were doing when people were talking about these traffic stops, you know, unnecessary traffic stops that the officers were making. You know, just to get that extra 2 hours or 3 hours, you know, one guy was notorious. He would try to make it turn it into three. How are you at work 3 hours writing citations? You can do that during your course of work. You get it done throughout the day.
You know, Pam, I'm going to touch on the whistleblower situation and also the godlike feelings that I believe a lot of police officers have, even being immortalized in death and so forth. But first, I'm going to go with, when I say the whistleblower, I'm going to talk about Nicole Martinez and when that Frank Jude situation. I talk about her because when I was in Cudahy, she used to be an auxiliary. She used to ride along with me. She wanted to be a police officer really bad. So that was her thing. She wanted to be a police officer. And I know in that Frank Jude situation, when she arrived on that call, you know, because they had talked the ambulance into leaving, and she ended up taking Frank Jude to the hospital in her squad car, And then she got wrote up by Haggerty at that time for, you know, not having them go in the ambulance and so forth. But she got death threats and wouldn't get backed up on calls. And she eventually resigned on a medical disability. And, you know, and to this day, you know, I mean, it's like a badge of honor when people, when these police people talk about it. And the union, the police union didn't back her up. So you know, when we talk about people stepping forward and so forth, and they see something like that, a young person that, you know, moved up in the ranks and so forth and wanted to do all the right things and so forth, and this is how she was treated. And we know how dangerous it can be. And then the other thing is that I can't think of the other young man's name that was killed. He was a city worker, and I think he was hit by a car. But it was the same time that where this officer was also killed during a raid, and he was the first one going through the door. But the city worker got recognized only, I think, because timing of his death was a day or within the same week of that officer's and so forth. But there was fundraising after fundraising for that officer. There was a couple for the city worker, but there were tons for that officer and his family. And I think they're still having something on kind of like a yearly basis and so forth. And I think I'm not putting people down and so forth, but the thing is, these people feel that they are more entitled than anybody else in life or death. And I guess, Ricky, you can, your feelings and thoughts on that. Or go ahead, Pam.
Okay, so when you talk about whistleblowing, because that's what you're talking about, is that you have to have the spirit. You know what I'm saying? You have to have the tenacity. You have to have the gumption about you to stand up for what's right. That's just the bottom line. And speak on what is the truth. Now, when officers don't speak out against each other, some are, because there's a law that you cannot speak, you can't speak on personal police business or anything like that. You don't have the right. So you can't speak for the Milwaukee Police Department in any capacity. And if you are an active officer working within Milwaukee, now we're retired, so we can say whatever reason. But at the same time, it's like, that's why you have some officers who are not speaking up, you know, just by, there was a sergeant who commented on a post on Facebook about something an officer said about telling somebody to go back to Africa if they felt that way. And he said something to that person, and it went to internal affairs, and they gave him an official reprimand. So here's what I'm saying. People are intimidated, you know, about, or like, have to be careful about what it is that they say without fear of repercussions and consequences. So, but at the same time, I was that person that spoke up and out. And I'm not saying I didn't care where it lied, but I also made sure that I followed my rules, guidelines, procedures, and policies whenever I was speaking up and speaking out. Make sure my ducks was in a row before I start blabbing off about somebody else that's doing something. I was not afraid to put pen to paper at all, ever. I don't even if it was a boss, I would write that person up. But you have to be prepared for what comes behind that, you know, the transfers or somebody, you know, putting something on your time card or, you know, in your like that, you know, the harassment part that comes with it, but you know, have to deal with that as well, you know.
Right.
Document every single thing, who was around, what was said, what time of day. You have to document and you have to keep that memo book or whatever you're writing in close to you. So whenever you pull that, going in front of the supervisor and they're trying to say something to you or whatever, just, hold on one second, let me get my memo book out so I can write down verbatim what you said. So when, you know, if something happens later on, I have this information. You know, but at the, now we'll speak about, Matthew Rittner was the officer that was killed. Matthew Rittner worked for me, the one that did the entry. And then the young man, the city worker was killed. I know Tracy then had a vigil for both of them, and I was a part of that. And what happened was, you know, in the they also had something at City Hall for the city worker that was killed as well.
Right.
It's up to each individual person, whoever, like with the city, you know, for them to continue, and they want to continue to memorialize or remember their loved one every year, and, you know, during the birthday times or holiday times, that's their choice. And at the same time, if Matthew Ritten's family, what we didn't know at the time, Matthew had a 2-year-old son. We didn't know his wife was pregnant. So, you know, that's right. Why they like continued on with fundraisers, because even though he's going to get some type of burial, she's going to get some type of benefit from his burial benefit or something like that, or insurance, it's still, you know, a hardship upon the family, because they it's something that they're not expecting. You know what I mean? You know, no one expects to go to work and catch a bullet right, you know, in your neck, you know, and shatter your collarbone or rifle bullet. So you just think you're going to go to work and do your job. Every day is not the same. And we realize right. that as often. And it could be that one moment that it's our day. But, you know, hope and pray and thank God you're on the right side of living right. And people will remember who you are. So as tragic yeah. as it is, and a reason why I can see the reason why they were doing what they have done, and the reason why they continue to have something for him. I personally don't think it's a sense of entitlement for him and her, only because just having, trying to raise kids and having kids within itself, that eventually that insurance money is going to run out, you know? So, and it's just probably people just trying to cope. And I have no problem with officers trying to cope with death. We lost 4 officers within a matter of 2 years. So you got to think, you know, we lost Michael Mahalski. You know, he was shot chasing right. some guy as he's going up the stairs. He just stuck his arm around the door as he's coming up the stairs. He caught the bullet. He went through his chin and went straight down through his chest. You know what I mean? Those are freak accidents. Like, how does that happen?
Right.
But, you know, but you're not thinking a person's just going to stick his arm back and shoot you, you know, and when you've done this job 1,000 times, and it's always, you know, and Michael had given his life to God right before this happened as well. There's a video of him talking about that in church.
Mm.
And so when you think about the officers that we lost, and then the kid in the car pursuit, you know what I'm saying? And he's his partner's driving, and they don't have on their seatbelts. And this all this stuff is, you always put your seatbelt on. But this kid is, you know, in a pursuit, and his partner, you know, divot in the road, and the car bounced up, and next thing you know, it was tumbling, and this kid was ejected out of the car, and as the car is flipping, the car is landing on this kid who looked like a buck 05. So there were a lot of deaths that year, so the officers were trying to cope with it, and quite frankly, some of them are still trying to cope, because these are babies. When I say babies, you're talking about 21, 22, 23-year-old kids. They haven't lived like you and I, Horace. You know what I'm saying? We got time on, and Ricky, you know what I'm saying? But it's like, you've seen officer-involved shootings. You've seen citizens kill one another. You've seen all of these things. But then you have an officer that is, you know, have 5 years on the job, and all of a sudden, now you have to deal with their mind, their psyche. You know what I'm saying? That was
right.
My biggest proponents is that while we're sitting here talking about mental health for everybody else and the 6 pillars of policing, we need to have mental health for officers. We need to have training for officers. We need to because they need somebody to talk to as well. Yeah, I put my uniform on, and boy, I tell you, they call me a crime fighter. I love that name. But at the same time, it's like officers get weak as well. There's something that's going to trigger and send you into another planet. For me, it was my sister-in-law committing suicide, and then my other sister-in-law dying within the same year, and then a friend of mine committed. So it's like, it's just like all of that stuff wears on your mind, your brain, and your heart. Now I need to go and talk to somebody because I feel like I want to commit suicide. I mean,
right.
But that's not what I want to do. So I just didn't think that it's a sense of entitlement among the officers. I think they're genuinely trying to feel like, you know, trying to cope with it. Because one of the things about an officer-involved shooting, and one of the things about an officer getting killed, is that they do not talk about suicide with these cops. That's the one thing they don't. We had Tom Klein just committed suicide a month ago. Dover at the park and went and stood in front of a squad car and put the shotgun to his chin and blew his brains out. Crazy. Because he got transferred from one district to another. That's awful.
And you know, Pam, I went through that myself where I had those thoughts and so forth. So, I mean, I'm glad I didn't make those decisions, but I've done some things where, you know, but I think we've all went through some things just with the struggles and so forth and this and that, and that's part of the job. And so there is a lot to say about the mental psyche, and there needs to be an evaluation that needs to be a regular thing with officers. So I appreciate Brother Charles bringing some of the things up and some of the programs that he does with the police and so forth. So, and I just want to thank you guys for being on tonight and sharing your experiences and what you think things look like in regards to the violence and you know, and the death and, you know, with the policing and others that are dying and so forth. And, you know, how do we move forward? You know, what difference, you know, can we make? What can we do to change things? I know that we're all doing as much as we can. You know, and at some point, whether they listen or not, we're going to make that difference. I mean, that's just how we move. And I just want to thank you guys again. Thank you.
Brother Harris, we have, are we open to our listeners to call in at our number, which is 215-490-9832. There was an Officer Malone there, and I don't know if they're still here with a comment or a question.
Officer Malone, are you here? Well, I guess we might have lost him. Is there another caller?
I don't have another at this time, but I do want to remind our listeners that sponsors are welcomed. Do you have a service you want others to know about? Have you written a book we need to read? Consider becoming a sponsor. Email the Black Reality Think Tank at Sankofa_think@outlook.com. Contributions to support our broadcasting efforts can be made to Cash App or PayPal. Cash App, use the account $Nirvana, INSTI, and PayPal, Sankofa_think@outlook.com. So I've opened it up to others being a sponsor, but also we do have a sponsor, EDOC Advice. And at EDOC Advice, we provide specific medical answers to those seeking a better understanding about medical conditions and health. We offer our faculty of EDOCs, who are licensed physicians and health professionals, who make themselves available to those globally seeking a better understanding of health issues and medical practice.
Thank you, Dr. James.
Thank you, Dr. James.
Yes, sir. We are so delighted. We've had such a wonderful conversation with these two retired officers. We are grateful for them taking up this as a career and continuing the effort. Again, I would encourage you to continue to stay involved. I'm sure it's taken a long time to build up the history and the knowledge of how the organization operates and how you can serve as a mentor to support those who are already in the profession and being able to encourage others to do as you have done and more to help in the issue of policing.
Thank you. And just so you know, three retired officers.
Three retired, that's right. That's Brother Horace, we don't ever forget that you're part of the group and help give us some insight to think about some things that we might not otherwise think about.
Do we have time for one more comment?
We do.
Well, I know we ran out of time. I had actually I had four questions, and we just need to have them come back. But regarding the $9.7 million earmarked for hiring 30 police officers in Milwaukee Police Department, that it looked like the alderman voted against receiving the money. And I know we've had conversations in the past, Sister Pam, about the need for funds. And I was just wondering if perhaps we could find a way to have Congress earmark that money for hiring police officers specifically who reside inside the city of Milwaukee. And then the other question I was wondering about, which I have to say about the reinstatement of former police chief Morales, and then the Fire and Police Commission, you know, how effective they are and whether or not that needs to be overhauled. I know that's four questions. And we got 3 minutes.
I can personally say all of it is a mess. And it's horrible. The leadership is horrible. You know, starting from the top, you start from mayor because he appointed those people to the Fire and Police Commission, but they didn't have their businesses, their ducks in a row. That's how Morales is able to try to come back because they did not take care of that loophole. So he will come back and probably get paid, but I don't think he will come back on the job. To serve, and that would be a costly mistake for him because then they could probably turn around and fire him. You know what I mean? You don't want that on your record. So it's a whole lot of stuff. And the city attorney governs, you know, they get their following their rules from the Fire and Police Commission. So that's Tierman Spencer. And a lot of people are at fault in this, and it's awful. And it's a bad position, a bad way to be in, especially the fact we don't have a chief. Right now we have acting chiefs, and you know, we could be in one of the worst situations right now. There is people are dying daily and they're just not doing what they're supposed to do. We could have a terrorist attack. What they gonna do at the chief's level if they don't know about it? And as far as money that's gone, that's a grant. You know what I'm saying? They spent money and done something with it. Hire 30 more officers. When they see that mass exodus of officers and they're complaining about the calls for services are going high and people have been waiting for a long time, that's the common council's fault. That's, you know, trying to hire more officers and officers are leaving. That's on them too.
Yeah, we're not going to be able to keep up with the number in regards to hiring, and then the class, there's no classes have been postponed and so forth. You know, they're saying they don't have the money.
Right.
Well, Brother Horace, we've enjoyed having your guests on, and it's coming up to the time that we need to say good night and stay safe. We thank our Sankofa guest, Sister Dee Dee, definitely our host, Brother Horace. And I am glad to be here with you, Dr. James. And thank you again to our guests for being here tonight.
You're welcome. Thank you. I have it.
Thank you.
Tennessee. Thank you very much.
Tennessee. Thank you, Brother Horace and Sister James. Tennessee.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Tennessee. Lord, I've really been real stressed, down and out, losing. Not just my spare tire, but Lord, I ask you to be my.
Crocodile and Baba, they went down to Peachtree. Headliner, I challenge you to a game of horseshoes. A game of horseshoes.
Now I see the importance of history. While my people be in the mess that they be. Many journeys to freedom made in vain. By brothers on the corner playing ghetto games. I ask you, Lord, why you enlighten me? Without the enlightenment of all my foes. You said, cause I set myself on a quest for truth. And you were there to quench my thirst. But I am still thirsty. Lord, allow me to drink some more. He said, what I am searching for are the answers to all which are in front of me. The ultimate truth started to get blurred. Some strange reason it had to be. It was all a dream about